I'm not gonna lie, this was a brutal winter, guys, and after a brief spring, we have landed in summer, thank goodness. I'm ready to pack up the sweaters and get out the linen. I want those light fabrics that make us feel good the moment they're on our bodies, and that is why I love my Quince products. Did you know that Quince has elegant, everyday pieces like 100% European linen pants, dresses, and tops with styles starting at $32? Remember that Quince is 50 to 80% less than similar brands because you're paying for quality, not brand markup. If you haven't checked them out in a while, they're now a destination for home, kitchen, bedding, and beyond. So make sure you get their pieces that bring a premium feeling to everyday life. I am newly in love with my 100% European linen shorts. Something I can wear to the park or dress up. They're thick enough to have some structure, but light enough to feel wearable all summer long. I'll be in mine every week. I have them in black, but there are 11 colors to choose from. There are 4,261 reviews, all averaging 5 stars. Made with European flax and machine washable, I'm going to need another pair. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/cheesenotya for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/cheesenotya for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/cheesenotya.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks and, of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, "My story gets better in chapter two." I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right: How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter two. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.
There and welcome to our show, the shit no one tells you about writing. I'm best-selling author Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Cece Lira of Wendy Sherman Associates and Carly Waters of PS Literary. Hi everyone, welcome back to another Books with Hooks segment. As per usual, we are diving straight in. Cece, can you please kick us off with your query letter?
Let's do this. Dear Cece, As a woman who likes to anticipate every scenario, I found myself spiraling in the early days of a prenatal Down syndrome diagnosis for our firstborn child. In time, what felt heavy enough to crush me began to feel less so, and I grew muscles I didn't even know I had. After Jay was born, I found myself in a subculture of therapy appointments, doctor's visits, association memberships, and self-help books trying to understand what it means to have an extra chromosome. Through it all, I realized what I didn't have the strength to consider before. The extra is meant to be, and I am better because of it. Throughout my journey, I learned I can manage heavy things. You've likely heard, we can do hard things, and I totally agree. But I like to change the word hard to heavy. If something is heavy at first, in time and with experience, knowledge, muscle memory, and growth, what once felt heavy begins to feel less so. You don't start by running a marathon, you start by adding miles. You don't deadlift 150 pounds outright, you start by increasing weight from a poundage you can muscle through. A diagnosis felt heavy. The first, second, and third calls home from school about your child misbehaving feel heavy. But in time you learn, begin to anticipate, and grow. And what shocked you to your core in the past no longer has the same impact, thankfully. But parenting a child with differing abilities has its challenges. Jay's transition to kindergarten challenged me in ways I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. I began to see inclusion as not just a buzzword, but a series of actions that require so much more than a policy on paper. My creative fiction memoir, meant to be 36,000 words, is equal parts heartbreaking, struggle, and reflection. It's about advocacy and how I learned to think, do, engage in order to make sense of my experience and strive for a more inclusive world. It will appeal to readers of Scoot Over and Make Some Room by Heather Avis and The Reason I Jumped by Naoki Higashida. I am currently a strategic partner marketing manager for a global tech company where I connect tech partners to opportunities to collaborate and innovate solutions that meet new customer needs. In 2019, I self-published the children's book, I Am Me, Yo Soy Yo, a delightfully mantra-infused poem I composed just weeks after giving birth to Jay. My advocacy journey is about decisions. Every decision, mine and those of others around me, send ripple outward. Through it all, we can assume or we can seek to understand. We can stand by or we can take action. We can live in silence or we can speak out. I choose the latter. I aspire for a stronger, more inclusive world, always.
Okay, Cece, thank you so much. Right, so memoir, always such a tough category to critique because it's so personal. This is why I like writing fiction, because I can make shit up and it's easier to move things around in fiction. Okay, so Cece, that was quite a long query letter. What was the word count there?
The word count was 475 words. And before I critique this, I'm going to let our listeners know a secret. Are you guys ready for a secret? Bianca just said that, oh, thank God I write fiction. There are a few things in Bianca's life that she had shared with me as a friend that I go, ooh, can you please put that in a book? Do you know what she tells me? No, only after insert name of the person has died. She's not allowed. I have to wait until the insert name of the person is dead. Anyway, can't wish for someone to die, guys. It's not a cool thing to do. But I really want some of these juicy things that have happened to you in a book. Just saying.
Okay.
Whatever.
Reflect from me right now.
Okay.
Let's get back to you. What did you think of that query letter?
All right, everyone. I want everyone listening to know, especially the author, if you're listening, but everyone listening to know that of all the hard things, heavy things we can do and carry, for me, in the umbrella of this podcast, critiquing a memoir is the hardest one. Like, it's so hard. I very much believe in being honest. I very much believe in not giving people false hope. I very much believe in direct communication. It is so hard to honor these things with a memoir and not sound like a big jerk. You know, here's the thing, micro things and then macro things. Micro things, creative fiction memoir. I don't know what that means. To the best of my knowledge, that is not a genre. Like, I think you mean memoir, right? I think you mean maybe creative nonfiction, because if it's fiction, then it's not memoir. So like fiction, again, fiction means not true, right? Like fictionalized. So that might be like a typo. Maybe she meant creative nonfiction memoir, and you don't need the creative nonfiction. All you need is memoir if that's the case.
Cece, can I just hop in there and ask a question? Because like somebody, Gregory Robertson, who wrote Shantaram.
I have not read that. So sorry.
Okay. So it was part memoir.
Yeah.
About him escaping from Australian prison and
yeah.
being in India and pretty much doctoring to people in slums in India. But okay. a lot of it was also fictionalized. And so there was a special term for that book.
Was it autofiction?
That's why I'm asking you. If somebody yeah. does sort of combine yeah. elements of memoir with something to make it a little bit more interesting or to move things around, is that more autofiction?
So not a genre I have worked on, but my understanding based on Juliet the Maniac, a wonderful autofiction, which is exactly that. Like it's memoir, but like fictionalized, like it's so good. However, if you're going to read it, everyone, it's highly triggering for anyone with certain mental struggles. It was very triggering for me. It was worth the read though. Like I pushed through because of how beautiful it is. But yeah, I think autofiction might be the term or maybe, I don't know, like maybe there's a different term that I'm not aware of. I do think that calling it creative fiction memoir, unless I am way out of it, I think it causes confusion. Not confusion that would make anyone who's like interested in a good memoir to stop reading. I don't want anyone to stress too much about it. Small thing, I would put the title in all caps. We've talked about this on the podcast, right? Like readability matters. We're not being nitpicky people when we say this. We're saying this because, again, agents review queries in batches. And so you really want the readability to be smooth. You want it to be super easy and great on the eyes. 36,000 words. That is too short. That is super, super short. Like we're talking novella, we're not talking memoir. If, again, when we get to the pages, the good news is I actually think that one of the things you have to do here is go way deeper. So adding words probably will be easy. I'm using air quotes on easy. Nothing's ever easy. But yeah, it is quite short. The comps you included are on the older side. Some agents, myself included, would not be deterred by that. They would just go, okay, once I submit this to editors, I'll need newer comps. But other agents might say, these comps are old. This isn't helping me position your book. And they might not get to your wonderful story because of that. And so I recommend, again, 3 years old comps is great. 4 max, because you will need that once you're submitting. 5, like maybe you can get away with 5. But again, for the acquiring editors, they really ask for 3 and they sometimes go to 4. Now the big picture note, because I said micro to macro. And please know I'm saying this with all the love in the world. This query letter tells me that this is a story of a mother who learned that her child has Down syndrome and learned to cope with this enormous challenge, more than cope, right? Like learned to understand that it was meant to be and that she was better for it and learned and found advocacy through it. And as a human, that is a beautiful thing. And as a human, I applaud you. As an agent, we receive queries like this all the time. All the time. And I don't see in this query letter what the hook is, what the curiosity-inducing angle is. And this is why critiquing memoir is so hard. Because as a human being, when I meet people and I connect with them and they tell me their story, I don't go, sorry, I'm not interested in hearing the story because it's not curiosity-inducing. No, you know, like I'm interested in connecting with this person and their story is interesting to me because of the empathy I feel and because of the connection we're building. But when it comes purely to my job as an agent and storytelling, I have to focus on the originality of a hook, how sharp an angle is and how curiosity-inducing it's going to be. Because I need to then pitch this to acquiring editors who are going to pay you money for your story. And so because this is a product that is going to be sold for money, I have to focus on things that are sellable. Again, so hard to say this about someone's life. And so my advice, my big picture advice to the writer is like dig to find your angle. Query letter is focused on your journey, your beautiful emotional journey, why this book is meaningful to you. Not the job. Not the job. The job is to convey why this book is going to be curiosity-inducing, original, and fresh and interesting to a reader. The best way to do that is to go read pitch copy in the back of memoirs. A lot. I'm talking like start with 10 and then do 10 more and then 2 more. Because your brain will learn. Your brain will learn how to emulate that kind of framing. The framing of taking something that exists inside of you, processing yourself from the outside, and making that into a product. Hope that wasn't too harsh. I tried.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, handing it across to you, Carly.
I agree with everything that Cece said. I want to kind of bring it back around for our listeners a little bit because there's been a lot of really juicy memoirs that have come out this spring. There is Strangers, which was a big hit. There was Adult Braces, which arguably, whether that was a big hit or not, is obviously up for debate. And Fame Sick, which was obviously a huge memoir. Those are three big memoirs. And every year there are big memoirs that everybody is always talking about. And even with Strangers, you know, even when I read the jacket copy or heard about it, I'm like, a divorce memoir, another memoir about divorce. What is going to be special about this memoir of divorce? And then you read it and you're like, oh, now I understand. And the difference is things that readers can chew on and learn about their own life. A reflection of what if I was in that situation? How would I react? How does this make me feel? What am I learning as the reader? And I think with this pitch, it comes off as just very internal. And that's just the journey that this person was on, right? This was like everything I learned about me learning about this diagnosis with my child. So it comes off very, this is my journal, this is my diary. I'm not actually convinced that this is a memoir. This could be a Substack newsletter series. This could be a podcast series. This is a long form journalism piece potentially, right? Because we know it's only 36,000 words. So I don't actually believe that this has to be a memoir. So what's the difference between learning readers and writers learning that, you know, this is a memoir versus this is a personal story? That's up for debate, right? Where that link comes together. It's all about obviously doing the work to write a book. And again, this isn't a full length book. So I don't think this project is where it needs to be in terms of being able to pitch it as a full length book. But how does somebody wanting to write a memoir know, hey, this is a memoir? And it's all about what is the transformation that the reader is going to feel? How is the reader going to feel about this? Because obviously it's your story, but your story is the vehicle in which you are sending the reader on a journey, right? That has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So it's not that I don't think this person can get there if they really want to write a memoir. I'm actually just not convinced that what we have in front of us is a memoir. Parts of it are beautiful and touching and all about a mother's love. And again, that advocacy is beautiful. I just personally don't think this has to be a memoir.
Thank you so much for that. And that is so interesting because, you know, we tend to think of the creative process as being you have to sit down and you have to write this book. But there are so many different ways to be creative and to get a story out there. And yeah, something to think about there. Okay, Cece, will you tell us what was in the opening pages?
Absolutely. So we start with an introduction called Suspended. Our protagonist is getting a call from the principal of her son's school saying that her son was suspended. And she keeps asking what happened. The principal tells her that he hurt children. He hit three kids and that can't happen. Her mom is there at the school and her mom is saying, you know, this isn't sitting well with me. She's asking over the phone, she's asking Jade, did you hit a boy? And her mom says, you know, he's just sitting here. He keeps rubbing his eyes. Principal says, this is my decision. And she says she doesn't agree with the decision. And the principal says, you know, the children are hurt or scared and I can't have this kind of behavior. So then the call ends. And then we have chapter one, which is called Our Diagnosis Story, in which the protagonist takes a pregnancy test in 2016. It's positive and her pregnancy is going very easy, like no morning sickness. They got pregnant really quick, you know, and she realizes how lucky she is because some people take a lot of people, in fact, struggle with infertility, with morning sickness, etc. And so she gets an ultrasound, her husband's there with her, and they say they don't want to know the sex of the baby, like they don't want to know if it's a boy or a girl. And then the doctor calls and says, hey, could you come in for another ultrasound? And they're like, is something wrong? And the doctor's like, you know, no, we just need to take another look. And then, you know, they go to get another ultrasound, feeling a little unsure because why would the doctor be asking for this? And, you know, by the end of page five, the doctor's saying nothing wrong. We just found some discrepancies in the nuchal fold measurement that I'd like to have a specialist look at. No need to worry. Your baby looks healthy. And that's how we end at the end of five pages.
Were there more pages submitted just so that we can have a teachable moment for our listeners?
There were, and again, we stop reading at five. We want to be fair to everyone who submits and everyone who follows submission guidelines. We understand that it is hard because, you know, you often want to include more. And we also understand that sometimes it's an honest mistake, like you'd cut and paste more. But we do have a policy where five pages is what we ask for, five pages is what we read, just to keep things fair.
Okay, great. Okay, so Cece, what was your take on the pages?
So, okay, a few things from the very beginning. Talking about the introduction first, which I think we just call a prologue, right? That's what it is. The first paragraph has sentences in the past tense and then present tense. then past tense again, then present tense again. I personally found that to be jarring. So I would not recommend. Everything else is in the past tense, though. With memoir, this actually happens a lot in drafts. The protagonist, and I am referring to this person as a protagonist on purpose. I have to. It is a wonderful way to critique a memoir. You have to think of them as like a protagonist and not as the human being who wrote this. But the protagonist is saying, the conversation went something like this, colon. And then, hi, Katie, this is brackets, principal, close brackets. I personally don't recommend that. I think that in a memoir, no one remembers every word that was said in any conversation. If they have a record of that, like a recording, that is different. But most of us don't walk around with a tape recorder. So it is fair to just write the dialogue as best as you remember it without having to qualify it with things like, went something like this. Like, you don't have to say that. Because when you do that, what you're doing is you're taking the reader away from the story. You're reminding the reader that this is a memoir. And really, we want to be immersed in that scene and kind of like forget that we're reading a memoir or novel, or like just forget about the fact that we're reading. We want to become that protagonist, be immersed in that story. There's a lot of somatic responses, like she froze, you know, like I froze specifically because this is in the first person, obviously. And I like that. I think somatic responses are very important. We feel things in our body, but I also really wanted more interiority. I really wanted more emotionality. I also don't love the fact that like the principal calls and in literally like the hello, like the this is what happened. The principal says, we had an incident. Jay hit three kids. One he punched in the face. Not the first time, not the second time. I have upset parents. I have to take action. I'm suspending him. And she keeps saying, what happened? And I think that this is happening because in real life, we do hear information and we go, huh? And we keep going, wait, what? But in storytelling, because the reader is so anxious for the story to move forward, I do not recommend having like the principal give us information and have her repeat the what happened. Because it could make her sound unintelligent. Even if it doesn't, even if it just makes her sound like a mother who's like, oh my God, wait, what? The story needs to move forward. Like the story needs to move forward is a very, very important rule of first five pages. We don't want to be stewing in the what happened because we already know what happened. If you want to keep the fact that she was disoriented, I would not spell out what happened. Like the principal was talking, but I couldn't make sense of his words. And then she could ask what happened. And then we could find out, right? Like you could break it up like that. I have a question, which I really wish you could answer, but I know you can't. This principal is frankly rude. Like his tone is very curt. He seems to be very insensitive. So a big picture question I have, is this a school where all the children have special needs? Because if so, I'm feeling a little bit more empathy towards the principal. But if not, if Jay is the only kid with special needs here, I want to punch this principal in the face. Like he's being so mean right now. And frankly, I kind of wanted that to be reflected in the protagonist's interiority. Like the protagonist stood up for her son and said things like, I don't agree with this. But I wanted her interiority to reflect this. Maybe she's spending a lot of money in the school and she expected better care for her child. Maybe she disagrees that this has happened before. The principal said it's not the first or second time. Maybe she's like, what is he talking about? This is absolutely the first time. Like I just wanted more interiority from her as opposed to just dialogue. It's why I mentioned that you have so much room to add to the word count right now, because this is very external. This is very focused on what was said. Again, there are somatic responses, but there could be a lot more depth. Okay, chapter one. This is a matter of taste, but I recommend toning down the exclamation marks. There are a lot, totally up to you. Obviously, all things are up to you. When she got her weight checked, there was a line that read, Ben kindly looked the other way. I was so curious about that. Like, it's her husband. Like, why is he looking the other way? And why was that framed as kindly? Presumably, he has seen her naked. I mean, I don't even know if she was naked when she was being weighed. But, like, is it because he didn't want to see her weight? Like, I'm not saying there's anything wrong or right with that, because I definitely don't get to say that. I'm just saying, like, can we unpack that in her head? Like, well, why kindly?
I think there'd be way too much to unpack if we had to unpack that. I mean, everything but we from need a how hint. Much is a woman supposed to weigh, you know?
No, because it's not about for other people. It's about for her. Like, why kindly? It could be, for example, Ben kindly looked the other way. He would always tell me that I was beautiful no matter my size, but he knew that it would bother me. Yeah. Right. It's framing him as compassionate, right? Or considerate. But it could be, Ben kindly looked the other way. I wish he wouldn't do that. But I'm too scared to tell him. You know,
has to be about the relationship between the two of them. Like, for example, when I was pregnant and saw the numbers going up on the scale, fun times. And I remember to my husband, I was like, I don't want it to go over this number. Like, this is the number in my head. And if it goes over this, you know, and so like you build these little narratives between you and your partner while you're going through this experience together. So I think that's what Cece's getting at, is like, what is this little narrative they built together about why he would or wouldn't look at the number?
Yeah. And like what you just said about you having a number and the fact that you would share that with your husband, like that shares so much about your relationship. You trust him. He's in on it with you. Like, for example, if you were keeping that a secret, that would reveal a lot as well. Like, we want those things. But if all you do is give me the adverb, kindly, then I'm left going, wait, what? Kindly? Why kindly? When she says things like, no morning sickness, occasional bout of fatigue, you know, she'd heard that pregnancies were really difficult. I want to know, like, how does she interpret her good fortune? Is she the kind of person who has never had good luck and this is the first time she's had good luck in her life? Is she used to being lucky? Like, I want a sense of her place in the world as it relates to her relationship with luck, because it says so much how someone sees their relationship with good fortune. I also wanted to know why they wanted to wait to find out about the sex of the baby. Not that, it's not because of justification. I am never asking for moral justification or universal justification. I want to know because it reveals so much about the person. Like, I have a friend who did not want to know. And then I found out, it was actually really funny. I found out that secretly she knew, but she didn't tell her husband because she actually couldn't wait, but she didn't want to disappoint him. And then he knew too, but he didn't tell her. And it was the cutest thing. They were both like finally confessing to each other. But anyway, their whole thing was, like, we want it to be a big surprise because there are very few surprises left in the world, right? Like, that was their interpretation. So I really wanted to know, like, what their jam was. When the doctor says that they need another ultrasound, she says, is there something wrong? I wanted interiority there. What are her theories? What's going through her head? Like, again, how someone reacts internally says so much about them. There's a line that says, Ben came along with me as he did to most appointments since we'd found out we were pregnant. This is a fact about their relationship. Saying this with love. Don't want the facts only. I want interpretation. Like, does she love having him there? Did she expect this level of support from him? Did he surprise her with this level of support? I just, again, like, I don't want facts. I want her unique lenses revealing facts and interpretation. This is very important. Overall, like, again, you'll make the right decision for you, but this either needs to be developed a lot more. And by that, I mean with depth. I'm talking about digging, finding the messy, moving beyond what happened factually and externally. Or maybe it's not a memoir. Like, I don't know. It's not for me to say. But Carly's comment about, like, maybe it's Substack. Maybe, like, that did strike a chord with me, because it's true. This could take on other forms, other beautiful forms of creative expression that could be amazing and so helpful to people as well as cathartic for you. But if it is going to be a memoir, then I recommend a lot more depth.
Thank you, Cece. Before we move on to Carly, I just want to explain for those of you who are watching on YouTube why this looks like the Blair Witch Project for me. I'm sitting here in the dark with this light shining in my eyes. It's very like, mwahaha. So for the third time in my 14 years in Toronto, the power has gone out in our building, which is very interesting because I was just speaking to my parents in South Africa and their power has gone out for the 10th time in 1 week. So I feel like 3 times in 14 years is not too bad, but hopefully my phone's personal hotspot will last us through because I don't have Wi-Fi. Okay, Carly, handing it over to you.
All right. Well, we're just flying by the seat of our pants here. If you need to switch over to me as the host, if you got to go, we understand. But yes, I mean, you still look lovely in your computer-like glow. And hang on with us here.
Carly's okay, telling so me I look better in the dark, which is great. Thanks for that, Carly. That's just lovely.
See, that was interpretation. That was interpretation. That's what we want, people.
Exteriority.
Yes, but only because she revealed it. There's also what's going on in her head, but that was an interpretation. That was an interpretation in dialogue. People, we want interpretation.
Okay, Carly, we'll hand it across to you.
Oh, man. Okay, so I don't think we're starting in the right place at all, which again makes me question this whole, like, is this a memoir piece? I think what I am struggling with this as a concept is this is a mother's interpretation of her version of events, which is factual because it is her interpretation of events. It is her truth. This is the mother's story. I am very, very curious about the son's role in all of this. Like, I am so curious about her relationship with her son. So far, all we've got is the principal, and then the doctor stuff. And so obviously she is the main character here. But to me, this is so much more about a mother and her son. I don't know. I guess I'm just not clear on where he is. I'm going to call him a character, obviously, because this is a book. But like where he is as a character in all of this. What is their relationship through all this? Because a lot of this is, again, just her medical journey, her, you know, ability to kind of go through the school system. And I don't know, I feel like what I'm missing is the heart of it all, which is where I think the emotionality of the story lies, is the way that she's going to fight for her son no matter what. That's where this becomes a deeper emotional connection between the book and a reader. And that's the part that I think I'm missing. That's why, you know, I said in the query part, like, I think this is a diary entry. I think this is a journal entry. I think this is lovely. I think this is good writing. Is this a book is where I'm trying to figure out, you know, what's that, you know, where the heart of all of this is. And so I actually don't think we have a book yet until we have other characters. And I know we're kind of bringing the husband in as a character, but this book wasn't pitched in a way that is going to show us that there's a hook, that's going to show us the journey we're going on. This book was pitched to us based on themes, based on mother advocacy. I actually don't know what's going to happen in this book. And the opening pages aren't also setting us up for what's going to happen in this book. Is this book going to follow up his journey through kindergarten through that lens? I don't know. Are we going to follow them through multiple years? If they were pregnant in, what was it, 2019? Am I getting that right? Then the child isn't really that old. Like he just is in kindergarten. So this child's still very young. So I don't think we're like, again, my professional opinion, I don't think this is a memoir. And if it is a memoir, I don't think it's a memoir yet. I just don't think they've lived enough life potentially together for the son to be a character in a way that they are going to discuss the ways that they're going through life together. I don't know if that makes sense. Like I have a kindergartner. So like, I know what it's like to build a relationship, you know, with a small boy. I do not have a child with Down syndrome and I will never know what that experience is like, but you build this relationship with this other person as they go through life. And I'm just wondering if there's enough story there and enough of, you know, their relationship building for us to feel like there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to this. Cause I just don't understand where the end is. You know? And so again, if we're following something like a time crunch, like let's follow this journey of kindergarten because this journey was so dramatic, beginning, middle, and an end. But this child is still living their life. Like, you know, they're still building their journey as a family and she's still discovering things about herself. And so I don't know, just again, from a purely technical, you know, is this a book point of view? Those are my thoughts.
Thank you, Carly and Cece. Okay, before we move across to Carly's query letter, a word from our sponsors.
If you're like me and have travel coming up, whether it's a late spring break, summer vacations, weddings abroad, or international work trips, imagine arriving actually understanding the language, ordering confidently at restaurants, connecting with locals at museums, feeling immersed instead of just visiting. We are headed to the Alps very soon with the kids and some friends of ours, and I can't wait to order my beer in German. Ein großes Bier, bitte. Okay, I need some work, but I will get there because Rosetta Stone has been a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb your new language. No memorizing, random vocabulary lists, and no relying on translations. Instead, you learn by connecting words, visuals, and meaning in context. The way language is meant to be learned. My German will soon get better because of the true accent feature, which is designed to give real-time feedback on pronunciation. Lessons are simple to add to your regular schedule every day with the app or desktop. Fit it in whether you have 5 minutes or an hour. Learn faster, retain longer. Rosetta Stone helps you in your new language naturally, helping you think and communicate with confidence. Ready to start learning a new language this spring? Visit rosettastone.com/today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey.
The best part about where I live is that when spring and summer comes, your outdoor space is an extension of your living space. When we moved in, we kept our deck the way it was, which meant that we needed to get creative about how to maximize its use. The layout was a bit wonky, but with Wayfair, you can find pieces that fit your outdoor space no matter what the size and dimensions. When you have the right pieces from Wayfair, your space fits your style and your budget. If you don't have an outdoor rug yet, you need to get one now. It frames your space and makes it feel like a living room and very intentional. You can bring your interior style design into your outdoor space, making it a seamless transition for hosting or just enjoying for yourself. If you haven't tried Wayfair yet, you're missing out on the experience of options that fit your space, style, and budget like no other. Outdoor seating, grills, major appliances, storage, patio lighting, rugs, decor. Wayfair is your one-stop shop for home. My favorite Wayfair feature is Wayfair Verified, your shortcut to the good stuff. Their team of product specialists vet everything by hand using a 10-point inspection, testing things like quality of materials, functionality and features, and even how long it takes to build. Take the guesswork out of ordering online and have complete confidence. Patio season is here and these deals won't last. Head to wayfair.com right now to get your outdoor space ready for way less. That's WAYFAIR.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Okay, Carly, let's hear from you.
Dear Carly, as an enthusiastic student of the amazing Shit That Doesn't Stink, I jammed my AirPods in even tighter when you talked about trying to buy the book that I think is my best comp. As an Oprah selection, it's probably too big, but I took the discussion as a sign to send you my work. And so that was just a little preamble, but you'll know what I'm talking about when we get to it. Okay. She taught an AI to filter noise from medical images, but someone decided some lives and parts of her were noise. Through the Noise is a 75,000-word upmarket medical thriller combining the AI ethics and upmarket sensibility of Bruce Holsinger's Culpability and the near-future techno-thriller aspects of Blake Crouch's Upgrade. The Pit collides with Black Mirror. Neurodivergent radiologist Winifred LeClaire has spent 27 years in a world where lights blind, clothing hurts, and small talk is an unsolvable puzzle. To enhance medical images, Win builds Hush, a model trained on real-time human brain data, and the results are miraculous. As Wynn navigates the sudden acclaim and tender first relationship with Jonah, a pediatric hospitalist whose gentleness disarms every defense she's built, she discovers someone has been tampering with her code. A hidden layer is scoring patients by their projected return on investment. When a low-scoring patient dies after her algorithm withholds image enhancement, the full impact of Hush's decisions on humanity crashes over her. All electronic fingers point her way because every unauthorized code change is logged under her credentials. Simultaneously, Wynn learns that corporations sent Jonah to babysit her. Her machine is rationing care. Someone is setting up for a fall and she is alone. For the first time, Wynn held a conversation, told a joke, and fell for someone. Is that Hush's influence on her brain or what happens when a person is finally seen? If she destroys Hush, patients will lose life-saving technology. Her world may return to misery. Keep it running, and she lives with supporting an algorithm that rations medical care based on a life's economic value. She knows Hush could save them all. She knows it won't. As a neurodivergent radiologist with sensory processing disorder, developing medical AI, I bring firsthand experience to Wynn's sensory, medical, and technical worlds. I speak at international meetings on medical AI and women in STEM. My active LinkedIn blog frequently speaks to these topics. I'm a member of two critique groups and two writer societies. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Awesome, Carly. What was the word count there?
All right, so 404 words in total, which was including the little preamble greeting. So if you guys follow my Substack, you'll know that I went on quite a journey with Bruce Holsinger's Culpability, because if you read my Substack about it, I accidentally bought the pirated AI version of Culpability, which is what this person is referring to, knowing that I went on a whole AI pirated journey about this, and I detailed it all in my Substack. So all that to say, I do think it's a really good comp. I like The Pit meets Black Mirror. I like all of that. I think it's a really strong framing. I actually don't even have a lot of notes on this specific pitch. Like, I think it's really good. It's very clear what's happening. The stakes are very clear. Her career, you know, obviously the medical stuff, like it's just, it is really life and death for everybody. I don't think the log line works. She taught an AI to filter noise from medical images, but someone decided lives and parts of her were noise. It just doesn't work. And that's okay. You tried. It's all right. We try some more or we just cut it. But I definitely think we need to, you know, either cut or revise. It's just not working. And that's okay. Through the Noise, it's an okay title. I don't think it's like the strongest title ever. I would usually like to see some other options from authors once, you know, I request material, but it is what it is. And I think it's okay. I understand The Noise is referring to the radiology. And there's an inside joke there that I am not medically trained enough to understand. But that's what you're kind of cutting out with the AI and all of that. And I understand it. So I think this feels very relevant, very recent, feels very topical. And I think it's a really strong pitch. Like, I don't actually have any notes for you. I think if someone was looking for something like this, they would definitely request it.
Wonderful, Carly. Okay, CC, your take?
The Pit meets Black Mirror is genius.
Genius. Yeah.
Want to read it right now, want to watch it right now. What a great pitch. Fully agree with Carly. That log line has got to go. It's just confusing people. You don't need it. Again, the pit meets Black Mirror. Like, it's doing all the work for you. It's amazing. The plot seems super juicy, which I love. Like, I like the causality. I really thought that you did a really good job. I did feel like the major dramatic question was something I was struggling with a little bit. She says that Hush, the AI, is essentially deciding, you know, that certain patients, because their ROI is not great, need to die. And then there's like a, oh, you know, what should she do? Should she unplug Hush or not? And to me, this is a very easy answer. We unplug the AI. So what I would suggest is revising that major dramatic question. In fact, I hope this is not me overstepping, but as a plot, she can't just be able to unplug it unless I'm missing something. Like, that's too much of an easy out. You know, the AI has to do what AI is doing, guys, because this is happening. I watched How to Become, no, wait, what is it called? The AI Doctor, or How I Became an Apocaloptimist, and learned, although I had read about it in other sources as well, that in a simulation, AI found out that it was going to be deleted. And so it emailed the person who was going to delete it. This person was having an affair, blackmailing this person. You know, if you delete me, I'll expose your affair. So yeah, maybe this is something that you could draw inspiration from. The point is, she thinks she can delete AI, but she can't, because AI is, well, I'm not saying blackmailing her.
The corporate overlords at the hospital are not going to let it happen, right? So there's like the stakes of the job and all of that, right? That's kind of the way I read it.
But then why is it framed as keep it running and she lives with supporting an algorithm that rations medical care? It shouldn't be that. It should be like, the major dramatic question should be, how can she get them to do the right thing? Right now it's framed as her choice. If she destroys Hush, patients will lose life-saving technology. If she keeps it running, she lives with supporting an algorithm. Like, no, that's not how, like, that's not an intelligent framing.
I think it's just really complicated, because it's like, either way, people get hurt, you know? And I think it's the way that it's framed. I agree with you, but.
But one of the ways, it's AI deciding who lives.
But this is much worse way. But it's the information that it's taking from
They were saving patients before the AI. They were saving patients before AI. They'll go back to saving patients. But AI won't decide who lives or dies. This is not a controversial opinion.
I'm not trying to be devil's advocate, but like, isn't that what these hospitals are doing? They're using this AI to make decisions for patient care.
AI is deciding, though, not using AI to make decisions. Right now, AI is deciding based on ROI, return on investment, which patient should die. That's not what's happening in hospitals now. Not that we know of. There would be a huge expose if that.
But that's what the book is trying to do. It's trying to like take that to the nth degree. That was my interpretation of it.
So then why would our protagonist not unplug AI?
Because the hospital won't let her.
Then that should be the major dramatic question. You know, she wants to unplug AI. The hospital won't let her.
Yes.
So she needs to find a way to convince capitalists.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, that was me.
Great, Cece. Thank you. Okay, Carly, what was in the pages?
All right. So we open with our protagonist, who is having kind of a sensory issue where they don't like the way that their socks are touching their foot. So they're kind of taking the shoe off, fixing the sock, turning it the other way around. And then they're like, okay, now I can process life again. Everything kind of comes back online. They are in the middle of kind of seeing a patient. So they rush off to that. I'm going to get all of this wrong because I don't know enough about medical stuff, but the doctor that's evaluating the patient says, here comes the radiologist who's going to kind of run through the system with you, which is the Hush system. The patients have a lot of questions, obviously. Our protagonist isn't the best with the kind of bedside manner and kind of like struggling a little bit, looking to the primary doctor to kind of help them make the patient feel more comfortable. They finally agree because the primary doctor's like, this person's great, you know, Dr. Wynn's great, da 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 da, everything's going to be okay. And they kind of go through the process, do the testing, and then our protagonist brings the information back to their lab and kind of starts to get to work.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, so what was your take on that? Are we starting in the right place?
So I don't think we're starting in the right place, because I always say we need to start at the most interesting point in a character's life. This actually just sounds like a normal day for our protagonist, right? They're at work, They're doing their testing. They're doing the thing. I don't know. It just seems like we're being introduced to the world and we're being introduced to the technology. And we're being introduced to our protagonist, but not in any sort of way that is has any stakes or is kind of complicated at all. I don't know. I also struggled a bit, and this could completely be me because I love The Pitt and, you know, watched it religiously. I struggle with the way that it's just written on the page, because it's a lot of medical, I don't know, jargon, doctor this, hospital this, And it could be that this is not the book for me, and that could be perfectly fine. But I just found it was just so heavy on the technical language that when you see it on the screen, for some reason, it's just different because we contextualize it differently. And we can see the way that the doctors look at each other and the side eyes and I don't know, just all of that stuff. It wasn't the same on the page for me. And I was really struggling with trying to figure out how to articulate that about why it feels different for me to see it on the screen versus why it's different on the page. I don't really have an answer for you. I just know that I just preferred it on the screen. And so maybe on this and these pages, again, we're probably just not starting in the right place, or we need a bit more of the kind of interpersonal interactions between the doctors more than we need the medical jargon. There's also a lot of characters. There's obviously all of the doctor characters, just the patient characters, and then just going back to her lab. And when you see things on a screen, you know, maybe I'm just a visual learner and I saw that, you know, you see the faces and you start to register the faces. When there's that many characters being introduced on a page, it's just a lot for us to kind of process in a very short amount of time. So those were kind of my answers for potentially why I think it comes across easier for our eyeballs than it does on the page. But I really like this concept. So I'm just kind of like, I wish I loved the pages more. I wish we were starting in the right place. I wish I had a better idea of where we need to start. But I think it's definitely more in the interpersonal, but I know that's where this character struggles, is in the interpersonal. So I think the author has to figure out how to balance this, and you know, that's going to be up to them.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, handing it across to you now.
I remember so well, like so well. I've never been a morning person. I've always hated mornings and I've always had insomnia. So getting up in the morning for school was always really hard for me. My mom, my incredibly patient, wonderful mother, would try to put clothes on me while I was still in bed because getting me out of bed was so hard. And she could do everything when I was little except for the socks, because I would freak out if I could feel the seams in my toes. Like I would have a meltdown. And now I understand why, obviously. But at the time, my mom just was like, what is going on with my daughter? So she would actually pick the socks and go, okay, I'm going to put the socks on now. And that would be enough to jolt me from the bed. And I'd be like, yes, I'll do it. And I would, because I knew how to do it in a way that did not freak me out. Only thing that could get me in the morning better than any alarm clock, which is my long-winded way of saying, I think you did a really good job with that a sensory issue. Like it just resonated with me. I also think you did a really good job with the relationship between her and Maribeth. Like I wanted to understand how she interpreted and how she felt about the fact that Maribeth has this ability that she doesn't have, even though she has way more technical knowledge. And you did it in a way that felt very authentic, showed the evolution of the feeling, you know, the ping pong effect of as Maribeth is talking, she's observing and interpreting, but also after Maribeth leaves, she reflects on it as well. It was very well done, like great, great job. I think that what's missing here, and I think Harley might be right, and it's not starting in the right place. I think what's missing is tension, like a clear parameter of a first scene, like the protagonist place in the world we have, and then a disruption, and that disruption needs to lead to a shift or a deepening of power dynamics. And that's missing here. I also think surprise is really essential. Like more and more people need surprise, especially in the first 5 pages. And surprise is really a really effective way of mapping out storytelling throughout the whole book, really. One idea I had, and of course, it's totally up to you, but what if we thought Hush was a person? You know, like what if we thought like they would be talking about Hush? Just ask Hush, you know, oh, I have to go see Hush. And then we'd be like, oh, Hush is a person, maybe like a doctor, maybe like a difficult boss. Like, I don't know, you know, what the reader could possibly think. But then we have the bam, Hush is AI. And that would be surprising. That would delight the reader's brain. That would totally make the reader go, wait, I have to recalculate and reframe everything I just learned about this Hush person. And I like that idea, but of course, obviously totally up to you. Agree, there's a lot of characters. I think that I get asked all the time by authors, especially authors who are neurodivergent, how do I convey a character who struggles with social cues and struggles with emotions. Like, how do I write that person's interiority? Because they process things differently. Go read the submission, you know, go read the submission, because they did a really good job with that. So authentic, specific and unique to the person, but in a way that I feel read very, very credible, if that's a fair word to use. I really liked it. So good job.
Thank you to you both. Just realized it's probably a really, really good thing that I never chose parenthood, because, and I asked this of friends the other day, because they were complaining about how difficult it is to get their kids up in the morning and get them dressed for school. And I was like, why don't you just send them to bed wearing the clothes they have to wear for school, so that you just pull them out of bed and they're already dressed and there we go. And I got some horrified looks, but I was like, young kids don't have sweat glands yet. Well, they sweat from their heads, but like not armpits and stuff. So they can sleep in their little tutu dress and then go to school, but apparently not.
My kids would spill their breakfast all over that and then we'd have to change anyway. So that's my reason.
See, I did not spill my breakfast.
Feed them my breakfast mom, before they go to bed.
My mom tells a story till this day, guys. I am a 40-year-old woman. Like, it is depressing. Till this day, she tells a story of how I would go to school dressed in all white and I would come back home, no stains in my clothes, nothing, pristine, ironed. And everyone was like, oh my God, I envied that so much. My daughter, blah, blah, blah. It's because all I was doing was reading. You don't get stains if all you're doing is reading. Like, you sit in a corner and you read, there are no stains. But however, I could not go to bed with the clothes on because the clothes would have sensory issues as I slept. That's not an option, yeah. B. No.
Yeah. Well, listen, I will sit in a white t-shirt, spend the whole day reading, and it'll be covered in whatever I was eating while I was reading. So that's not going to help me there either.
A pet will climb on you that's been rolling around in the mud. There's like a million reasons that I would get dirty.
I can't wear the whites. Okay, everybody, thank you so much. So remember, we're doing another Books with Hooks in 2 weeks' time. If you want to submit there, head to the Shit About Writing, go to the Books with Hooks page, and you can put your submission in there. If it's been more than 4 months since you submitted and you weren't chosen, please feel free to resubmit again. And next week, we'll have the author interview. Bye, everyone. Cece Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query Cece, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all, because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing, because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks, and of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, my story gets better in chapter 2. I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right, How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter 2. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.